Welcome to another episode of How to Save the World. I'm Waveney Worth.
And I'm Tim Batt.
And we're very excited to have our very first Olympic medalist here ever on the show, Sarah Walker.
Woohoo!
Hey, guys.
Hey. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, no worries.
It's good to be here. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, you too. Likewise.
So, I think you're a household name, of no introduction needed, but perhaps for those people who need a reminder, this is a 3-times world champion BMXing, and in 2012, the silver medalist for, BMX?
Racing.
Racing.
Yeah.
Just, that's it. Cover all.
On a dislocated shoulder, no less. So cool.
Yeah,
I love
that. Was pretty intense build up for sure. Like having a dislocated shoulder 3 months out from the Olympics and thinking like this, that's it, we're done.
And then smashing it and
yeah,
getting a silver medal.
I couldn't do a push-up at those Olympic
games. Wow,
yeah,
really?
I won an Olympic medal in BMX, couldn't do a push-up.
Wow.
So there's hope for everyone.
that's very inspirational, actually.
Yeah,
I can barely do a push-up. Maybe I should start doing BMX.
Exactly. I can do a push-up.
Maybe you could be an Olympic medalist too.
Maybe I could.
How many fractures and breaks have you had over your career?
So I'm pretty sure, the fact that I don't know 100% sure, but it's 18. I'm 90,
wow.
Probably only 90% sure it's 18. It's around that number.
I've had none.
Yeah.
I've never broken a bone.
It's funny though, because I'm probably, my skin sensitivity is way worse. So a graze, ripping the skin off your forearm or whatever, or knees. It's probably more painful than probably most of the bones that I've broken.
Oh, true. So when you're saying you have a heightened sensitivity to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So the bone level is less painful.
Oh, whatever.
You've just normalized
I know,
that. That's
like,
all.
Oh, this is annoying.
I bet it is actually.
Walk it off.
You're so competitive, obviously.
Yeah.
And then to have just time out like that. Have you been hospitalized? Why are we talking about this? I just got so interested suddenly.
Well, we've got you on for this Lightfoot project, of which you are now an ambassador.
Yeah.
Which we will get to very soon. But you do have such a fascinating career and job and everything that you know. There's questions.
Yeah, it's unique, that's for sure.
And why have you do a bit of biking? So,
me and Sarah. Yeah. Can I call you Shazza? actually, good thing you raised that, because this is our first Olympiast, and I reached out to Sarah specifically because I'm actually a big fan.
Oh,
and
thanks.
It's because I'm into biking.
Yeah.
And I just can say firsthand what a huge impact you have had for women on bikes or in sport generally, I think.
Oh, thank
I've
you.
Had you would, I'm sure you would know how that, because even the numbers we can see from just the sales of bikes and things, the numbers of women in biking has gone up hugely over the last
I was actually
decade.
Inspired by Sarah Ulmer as well.
Awesome.
Growing up, she was just an idol. So it is cool. And it's really weird also at the same time being an inspiration to others, because you go out into the world of sport and your goal is to be the best you can be and perform on the world stage and see what you're capable of. And your intention isn't to become famous, or it's not
exactly.
You're not going out to do that
.
And then it happens, but you're like, well, I'm just trying to ride my bike fast.
Yeah.
So it's adapting to all that, the different layers
and
levels that come with it.
Yeah.
It was really hard, especially I'm from a really small town out of Kawerau. And so 6,500 people there. And so going into a place and people recognize me at the mall or whatever. And it's just this is so weird. I grew up kind of wanting to disappear into the background, and here I am being shoved in everyone's faces. I'm like, oh, really uncomfortable. But there's always pros and cons, but definitely the pros outweigh the cons. But it's not normal still.
No, well, it's not normal.
I hope it's a bit easier than it used to be.
It is
I imagine
easier.
When that first starts happening, that'd be a big kind of mental weird thing to go through.
Yeah, well, so BMX wasn't an Olympic sport. And I was the first at the first Olympics for BMX in 2008.
Oh, wow.
So before that, no one really knew what BMX racing was at all. 99% of the time I'd get asked if I could do a backflip, to the point where every time I say no and they'd be really disappointed. And so to the point where I wanted to learn how to do a backflip just so I could say yes.
So can you do a backflip?
Well, I tried to learn, and tried was the main word.
Another broken bone.
No, well, it was into a foam pit, so it was a lot safer. But I learned how to do a 360, so I'll claim that.
That's harder, I would have thought.
Yeah, potentially, but less mentally challenging, because you're not going upside down, you're just rotating.
I was also picking up on the relationship you've got with Jesse Smith.
Yeah.
Three times world champ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who is Jesse Smith?
Yeah, tell us about
her. So Jesse is a young girl from Gisborne. She lives in Hamilton now. So I think she was about 9 years old when we were at a world championships in South Africa. And I was racing the elite class, and she was this little nine-year-old girl. And she'd finished racing. She'd done really well. And then it was my race day, and she was in the pits. In between races, she'd have a bottle with the fan spray thing for heat, because it was really hot in South Africa. And then on the other shoulder was a towel. And I'd just be in between races. I'd be like warming up or cooling down. I'd be like, fan. And she'd come over and spray me with water on my face and like hold the fan up while I was cooling down. And then I'd be like, towel. And she'd come wipe my face. she'd just been like right from that age. She's shown so much potential and talent. And so I've just kind of helped her as much as I could along the way. And yeah, last year she ended up winning the world championships for the junior women in Belgium. And yeah, so incredible. First junior woman title for a New Zealander ever.
Wow.
So really, really cool. But yeah, so.
In early days, you totally helped her find sponsorship and get gear and
show her the ropes. Yeah, so I would use my sponsors and kind of say, like, this is what I'm doing. Can you help me to help them? And yeah, pretty much everyone was on board. So it's been really cool to be able to use what I have to help others. Because like when I was growing up in BMX, like I said, no one knew what it was. So, and even once it became an Olympic sport, before it was in the Olympics, going to people and being like, hey, I'm trying to become an Olympian in this sport of BMX racing. Like just people had no idea what it was. And so it was really challenging. Me and my family would go up into the forest out the back of Kawarau, and we'd do forestry work for fundraising to try and get to like world champs and stuff like that. So it was a really hard journey, and so being able to use the profile that I gained from being an Olympian to be able to kind of make it easier for the next generation coming through.
Pass that torch a little bit.
Well, it was really rewarding
for
me as well, just to know that the sport has evolved so much since I started at that level. So yeah,
and it's like
cool.
You're claiming this little stake of it for New Zealand as well.
Yeah,
it's
pretty
thing.
Awesome.
It's excellent.
And what's happening, because this is an Olympic year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's happening in that space?
We're travelling a lot this year. So Olympic qualifying for BMX is over 2 years. And we just basically race all the World Cups, World Champs. There's lots of different layers to it. And basically each country gets as many points as possible. And depending on how you rank in the countries depends on how many people go for that country.
Oh, wow.
So right now New Zealand has one spot, but if we get one place better, we'll have two spots for the women. So right now we're trying to get as many points as possible to try and get to, because that would be amazing. But yeah, it's really unknown, because you're just comparing yourself to another country that's getting as many points as they can. So it's not... We won't know for sure until the end of May.
Still gaining points.
Yeah.
Okay, so end of May. Oh, so it's quite a nerve-wracking time
at
this point.
Yeah, but I've lucky enough, I've been through the Olympic cycle three times now. So 2008, 2012 and 2016. And it's kind of, I know that, yeah, that's all happening and it's all complicated, but I just have to focus on training as hard as I can and racing is the best that I can. And it's either going to work out or it's not.
So much of sports psychology, isn't it? Just getting the mind 100%, games.
100%, yeah. Like I reckon if I had more sports psychology training leading into Beijing Olympics, I would have medaled. I finished fourth by like 0.0 something seconds.
Right.
And you reckon you talked yourself out of, I can't do that.
No, it was more like my attitude was like, it's possible I could win a medal. Like, it would be pretty cool and it's not out of the question. But for London, I was like, no, I believe I'm good enough to win a gold medal. And that mind shift of, like, believing in yourself that you are capable of doing that or achieving that level.
Yeah.
That
can make a big difference, huh?
It is. It's a huge difference. So if I believed in myself that I could have won a medal in Beijing, I can.
Yeah.
Then I reckon I would have.
And I saw you actually make some comments about Jessie, who we were talking about before, that's something you're trying to imbue in her.
Yeah.
Is that self-belief thing?
So yeah, that's obviously something. It's not easy, and it's something that takes a lot of repetition and a lot of practice. It's like anything. Like, you're not good at it straight away.
Yeah, but it definitely works. That's why the All Blacks invest so much money in sports psychologists. Yep. Like,
100%.
All the sports that have all the money soak up these guys.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. It's kind of parallel as well because, so this is a sustainability podcast, yes. Right?
Just get back to that. We'll get there.
I'm starstruck.
I do want to draw a bit of a parallel because I think there is something so applicable about... There's so many reasons to despair or not do anything or get paralytic about certain situations that are happening with the environment in particular. But when you set that mental expectation and change that mindset of, like, view things positively rather than negatively, don't make things a foregone conclusion that they're going to go badly, but actually go, nah, we will fix this. We will suss this out.
Yeah.
You can just, like, unlock all this crazy human potential that you didn't know existed.
Yeah.
And I think as a sports person, you can see that in an individual level. But, like, when a society sort of makes that collective decision, you can unlock all this group human potential and suddenly these weird solutions come out.
Yeah. And I always look at it as... Like, believe that it is possible, but try. Like, just go and try.
Yeah.
And most of the time, if you believe it can happen, then it usually works out. But if it doesn't, then you can go, well, I tried.
Yes.
And I think that's something that's really important to me. And I'll go give examples that I can relate to more. But, like, for Rio Olympics, I didn't qualify because I got injured. So... But I got injured at the beginning of the year. I broke my arm in two places, had surgery, came back for the World Championships, was the last chance to qualify. Wasn't ready. Like, my arm was...
Injury, yeah.
Yeah, my arm was still not fully healed. But I was like, well, this is the last chance to qualify. I'm going to give it everything I have. And so I got on the gate at the World Champs in practice, did the best practice I could, and... crashed again. And at the time didn't realize, but I actually broke my shoulder on the other side.
Oh my God.
Strapped it up because I didn't realize it was broken. Strapped it up. It was a little bit sore. But
it was a little bit sore. Your broken shoulder.
But I got on the gate and I again did the best that I could with what I had and didn't make it. But, like, in hindsight, like, I did everything I possibly could have, and it didn't work out. But because I did everything I could have, and there was nothing more I could have done.
You feel good about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels, it's fine.
This is what we say too, isn't it? In terms of the environmental stuff that we're looking at, we've got sort of such a clear choice of just doing nothing because it feels overwhelming, or just approaching it with a totally different attitude and doing everything that we can and believing that we can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like an Olympic athlete.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone listening, you're an Olympic athlete.
Yeah. Doesn't matter if you can't do a push-up.
Wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, I am an Olympic athlete. Yeah. Can we talk about your recent move in becoming a Lightfoot ambassador?
Yeah.
So Lightfoot's really cool.
Yep.
I think, Wave, you probably know more about it than I do. I've got a little fact sheet here, but...
Well, there's probably more than I know. But they are cool. They've been around for a while, haven't they?
Yeah.
Almost 10 years, I think.
Yeah,
working with sports facilities mostly.
Yeah.
And just helping people to reduce their water, save waste, replace the light bulbs.
Yeah.
They've done some amazing, like, statistic-wise, they've actually done some incredible stuff.
Yeah, it's actually really, really cool. So, like, I love the idea of what they were doing. So they're basically going into sports clubs around the country and making them more sustainable so that instead of a sports club spending money on power waste, water, all those kind of like things that they need to actually still have to run a club, they can spend more of that money on more sports equipment. And I was like, this is so cool because like the kids don't really care about the light bulbs and the water. And
totally.
But they want to play sports. So if it means that they can get like an extra 10 balls for soccer every year or like.
Makes it more accessible for everyone.
Exactly. And it's really cool. But it also, the added benefit to the whole program is if you're going to sport and you're going to your club and you're seeing that they've changed to LED lights and they've put in like water restrictors so that they're using less water per minute and they've got recycling bins and all that kind of stuff. They're learning all about that sustainability at their sports club.
Yeah.
And then they're able to take that home and go, hey, what are we doing at home? And so that reach is really massive. So that was pretty cool part of it too, because if you learn at a young age, like about recycling and about saving water and about making sure that you, if you're using electricity, that it's like a more sustainable way to use it, then that's going to have more impact long term.
It's such a powerful thing to put into emerging athletes when they're really young.
Yeah.
Because then, like, every now and then you'll become an Olympic BMX medalist and get really famous and get recognized at the mall. And you've kind of got, like, that seed has been put in you from such a young age that you then can kind of, like, carry that out.
Yeah.
So it's quite a, like, efficient and effective way of getting the sustainability message
out. And the ones that
out.
Maybe miss the message, they get more sports equipment. So they're just stoked as well.
That's what I love about it, that it's this, like a great example of win-win, because so many things are put in terms of being like win-lose or you know, if the environment is getting a win, then that means you're taking away from something else. Yeah. But it's not compromise? The case so often. Like, this is a cost-saving thing for these sports centres and also really beneficial for the environment.
Yeah.
And the stats are pretty huge.
Yeah.
I'm just looking on my little fact sheet now. Install water-saving devices on taps and toilets that are saving 44.3 million litres of water each year.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's amazing.
Diverted more than 5,000 tonnes of waste from landfills each year. And there's almost 2,500 recycling stations in clubs now. They've replaced over 30,000 light bulbs to more energy-efficient ones. And they've only been going since 2011. And they've already got 166 clubs registered up.
Does your fact sheet say how much money's been saved on power?
And no. Like,
I think on the website there was a little bit. I remember it being over $1 million already.
Wow. And that's directly going back into
the
focus on sport and sports equipment.
Yeah, that's money that they're saving. Yeah.
And that's hard to fundraise that money if you're actually out there baking cakes or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So this is a bit of a twisty one, but you've recently been racing in Australia.
Yes.
And obviously in Australia recently, they've been having these incredible fires and stuff.
Yeah.
What, like, first of all, what was that like racing in those conditions? Like, just tell us what
was the search? It was really bizarre because, like, I've been following the fires for the last month or so. So we raced the last 2 weeks in Australia, flew into Melbourne and drove north up to Shepparton. Didn't really see anything that was kind of any indication of the fires. And then from there, we went to Bathurst, which is just inland from Sydney. Again, didn't really see a lot of it, but on the news at the same time, you're seeing it in other places. So between Sydney and Bathurst, there's the Blue Mountains, and that was pretty severely damaged by fire already before we got there. And the week before I came over to Aussie, there was a few BMXers already training in Bathurst, and they had posted that, like, they could barely see, like, the last straight from the starting straight because of the smoke from the fires was so bad because the wind that particular day was blowing in that direction, and they had masks on at the track and stuff. And so, like, we went over really prepared for that scenario. But I guess on the days we were there, the wind, well, it was actually a colder week, and the wind was friendly. And so it was kind of bizarre knowing that all that's going on, but where we were in that moment, in that time, it was completely fine. So it was kind of like this.
Yeah, yeah.
A bit on edge. And how about were there Australians there that had been affected or that were just really tired and frazzled and trying to get in their headspace for a race, but well, this is going on at home?
I think the Aussies that were there, I didn't talk to all of them, but because their home World Cup, they had a lot of riders, which is pretty cool to see. But like I had overheard someone at a cafe talking about they'd been like evacuated from their town, which was by Sydney, and this is when we were by Melbourne. So they basically had been told like they had an hour to get kind of their stuff and leave, and then like 10 minutes later they told just like to stay where they are.
Whoa.
So it's pretty hectic, and meanwhile you're somewhere else in Australia and it's completely fine. So it depends on the location. I guess it's similar to here, like last week I believe it was down the west coast of the South Island with all the flooding.
Yeah.
And then the east coast of the South Island was a fine day. So
yeah,
like it just depends on the location, I guess.
It's so tricky because it's like you kind of almost need to get that physical evidence of it before you can really have an emotional connection to what's happening.
Yeah, some of it seems really surreal.
So is this a thing that you're getting a bit more sort of attuned to, paying a bit more attention to, like in your everyday life?
I guess I've always been interested in what's happening in different areas and just kind of keeping up to date with general what's going on, and yeah, like stuff like this is just, it seems unreal. So like to be able to see something like that on YouTube is, I think, important also to just go, well, this is actually happening, especially the last 2 weeks being over there, not seeing anything directly myself.
Yeah,
it's like actually a reality check. I don't know if that's the right word, but at the same time, knowing everything that's happening in Australia, like for them to kind of survive and get through this on the other side, like they need tourism, they need people to go there and actually visit the place. Like, and I also saw that side of it, like people aren't going on holiday, or they're choosing not to go and stay at a hotel or go out to a restaurant. And so all the businesses are struggling too.
Yeah, I've heard this has a massive economic impact just with tourism alone, let alone all the infrastructure that's gone. The area apparently that has been burnt now, and this is a statistic that's already a couple of weeks old, is the actual burnt area is larger than the South Island.
Wow.
Dang.
Yeah.
That's crazy, first of all, but also quite a helpful visualization, or like
being able to relate it to New Zealand. Hectares, don't they? And you have just no idea what it means.
And you're like, okay, well, South Island's huge. Wow.
Yeah.
I understand that you've got a bit of experience building houses.
Yeah, I've it's like my hobby, I guess. not in the sense I've done it heaps, but like I grew up playing a computer game. This is real geeky. Like,
I love this.
Called The Sims.
Yeah.
I remember that.
I'd Google the cheat code to get unlimited money. And then I'd just build houses on the game. Like, I wouldn't actually play the simulation part of The Sims.
You didn't care about the
Sims,
people. You didn't care what they were doing.
Which is like the whole part of the game is called The Sims, as in the simulation. But I did the house building part and I just grew up doing that. And then I got to the point where I was looking at purchasing my first home. And I went into all these different homes and I was like, oh, like, it's a shame that's not facing that direction. And, like, it's really important for me to, like, look at where, like, parts of the house are facing in terms of the sun.
Yeah.
And, like, using the natural energy that the sun gives as well. And so after looking through a few houses, I was like, man, I could do this better.
Love it.
Awesome.
So I ended up getting a computer program and throwback to my childhood designing a house.
Seriously.
And then I ended up building it, and that was so cool.
That's incredible. So you were using like an AutoCAD program?
Yeah, pretty much. And then I got a professional person to actually draw it properly.
That's
with
probably
all
good.
The framing and everything, because they don't know all that part. But
you just taught yourself to do it on the software from graduating from The Sims.
Yeah, exactly. And so cool. So built it and then lived in it and got to like kind of see how the whole process went. And the design of how it actually was on a piece of paper versus how it feels to live in real life. And then pretty much from there, I sold that and then decided to do a different version and like do kind of the two ends of the scale. One was like a really nice place, and one was like still nice, but like more spec level.
Yep.
So what value for money, and what's worth spending the extra money on, and what's not worth spending money on, and just kind of understanding that part of the industry a little bit more. So for me, it was like my education, because full-time athlete, you can't go study an architectural course.
In the same way that with Lightfoot, they have had all these cool sort of sustainability outcomes, even though maybe their main focus was like saving money for the athletes. When you were designing and building that low spec house, did you find anything where there were sort of win-win solutions? Like you mentioned before, using the energy from the sun, is that in terms of like heating, obviously?
Yeah, well, that was my main one, was just making sure that, okay, the rooms in the house that I want to have more heat in summer, or the rooms in the house that don't need to be hot all the time. Like, so the bathroom, I chucked that in south because, like, you don't need the sun to heat up a bathroom because you're not in there.
Yeah, like, you're not living in it.
Yeah, exactly. But I wanted, like, the kitchen, dining, lounge area to have, like, really nice natural light coming in. Not just for, like, it being more energy efficient, but because it feels nicer. It's got that feel, like, when you've got the natural light coming in.
Totally.
So, like, it's not just about the house, it's about the well-being of the people that are inside the house too, like that feeling.
I think that particularly for houses, those two things are tied together.
Yeah.
That nice feeling of a good space, good light, it's well ventilated, and it's using, like, do you gotten into the thermal mass thing?
Yeah. So I looked into the foundations and making sure, like, okay, well, where is heat escaping and all that kind of stuff, and then looked into...
What did you find out?
Well, so we did, I think it's, I can't remember the brands, but like we did a thermally broken floor, but there's still a lot of heat loss that goes out the edge of the...
Sorry, what does a thermally broken floor mean?
Well, so there's, I think most builds have it as standard now, which is really cool, but it was like the foam blocks that go in all the concrete. Instead of it just being a concrete pad, you got the foam in there as well, and it just makes it a better...
insulator.
Yeah, exactly. But there's still a lot of heat that's lost out the edge of the slab.
Huh.
So you can also put like a thermal block out the edge of the slab, but that value for money was like, that's where it starts getting a little bit tricky, because that actually costs a lot more, and you're talking right on the edge of the slab. So like, is that worth it? Yes or no? But that was when I was building the more entry level.
So you really were getting into the nitty-gritty of dollar value for money stuff, these trade-offs.
Exactly, because like I wanted it to be, okay, well, if you're going, can you be sustainable for a cheap? Like, people think of building a sustainable house as being like just dollar signs.
Yes, totally. So I was trying, expensive solar panels and all
well,
the
like,
windows
what
cost
can
a lot.
You do that is more sustainable than standard, but without spending too much more than standard?
So what was the big answer to the question?
A good house design.
Can you build a cheapish house?
Yeah, you spend a little bit more for sure.
Yeah.
But I think that the biggest one was making sure that the floor plan is like the windows are the right size for the side of the house, and that you're facing the right direction. And actually, like the program I had like the latitude and longitude of the section and where the sun comes into the house at what time of the day on what day of the year, so you could see in summer where the sun's coming in and where it's coming in winter, so that you can adjust.
Do you have any stuff in your head, like looking further down the track, that you've got to focus on in terms of sustainability things?
Just, you know, forget about the Olympic Games. It's no big deal.
No, it's there's so many things that we can do, which is, I think you've used the word already, like overwhelming what you can do, but also exciting. Like, I think there's so many opportunities and potential for different things that we can do. Probably my biggest area at the moment is I'm on the IOC in the Sustainability and
Tell
Legacy
us what
Commission.
IOC is.
So the IOC is the International Olympic Committee. So they run the Olympic Games, summer and winter, and youth Olympic Games. So that's pretty amazing to be a part of that. Because like when I was 8 years old, I decided I was going to be an Olympian. I watched Daniel Loader, the swimmer, win gold in Atlanta. And I was like, yeah.
That's a bit of me.
That's what I want to do. Like,
and sorry, you're part of the what committee?
So I became an IOC member as an athlete representative mm-hmm. on the Athlete Commission. But the Athlete Commission and the athlete voice is really important across the whole organisation. So the athletes that are there as athlete reps, we kind of get divvied up amongst all the different commissions at the IOC.
I see.
So there's a lot of different ones. And so we get put on kind of one or two different ones. And one of the ones I'm also on is the Sustainability and Legacy Commission at the IOC. So we talk about the sustainability of internal stuff at the IOC, but also what is the, like, how do we make the Olympics sustainable as well? Not just in the traditional terms that you immediately think of in terms of sustainability, in terms of energy and waste and stuff like that, but also, like, how do you make the Olympics relevant so that people still want to host the Olympics and that we still have an Olympics moving forward as well? Because, like, it is really important to have those inspiring moments. So how do you, like, ensure that that can still happen too?
As a committee member, I'm sure you can't comment on this, but the first place where my head goes is there is a bit of a history of host cities for the Olympics building these huge structures and then them not really having a purpose after the fact or not being utilized to the best of their potential. Are those the sorts of conversations that are happening?
Those are absolutely the conversations. So, like, yeah, you had the last time LA hosted the Olympics was the first time that the Olympics actually made a profit and the rest of them were all at cost. So
why do countries want to host the Olympics so badly? It's always,
it's a good question. Can you compare the Olympics to anything else that exists? It's like such a unique event. And speaking as an athlete that wanted to become an Olympian, like, there's nothing in the world that compares to it. And as a young, impressionable 8-year-old, my life changed by watching that Olympic Games. And so I tried all these different sports. I pushed myself in not just the sporting area of my life, but even in school and stuff like that. So, like, I was inspired to just
be a better person.
Exactly. And so, like, you can have someone that's, I don't know, a musician that watched the Olympics, and they might be inspired to just be a better musician. And part of the thing that makes the Olympics so cool is you've got 206 countries all coming together from all different backgrounds and cultures, and that doesn't matter. We're all there together as one. And
we really don't have any other good examples of the
race,
world.
Religion, like, that's all irrelevant.
Hmm.
You're just there being the best versions of yourselves with everything and all together. And it's really hard to explain what it is actually like.
I think you've done a good job, though. It sounds amazing. Yeah, that's a really good way of putting what are, like, aspirational if you're an athlete and inspirational for anyone else, kind of vision of what the Olympics is and what it represents in terms of humans getting together.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what we need to do right now for climate change as well, you know? It's, if there was anything to use as a bit of a model to leave all your shit at the door.
Yeah.
We all got to get together and, like, do this one thing together.
Yeah. Well, it's such a positive environment that everyone's kind of leaving the negativity out of it and just focusing on how amazing individuals and people and all these countries and the performances, and it's just about the positive side, and it's such a cool place to be in the Olympic Village.
And if the athletes can do it, you've just set the bar. You've just showed us all that it is possible.
What can you tell us about, like, being involved in the Sustainability and Legacy Commission, is it?
Yeah.
Within the
IOC.
Like, how many countries are on that commission?
Good question. I would say less than 20.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's actually chaired by the Prince of Monaco, which is also, like, being around like literal royalty.
Yeah.
Is a bit bizarre as well, but like,
crazy life.
Oh, it's insane.
The unintended consequences of BMX.
Pinching myself sometimes. But it's pretty cool as someone that looked at the Olympics and had that aspiration for so long, to also become a part of the organization. Yeah. Like, I was a little bit nervous, to be honest, because, like, you read stuff and places and how bad it is and it's whatever.
The internal, like, organization.
The negative side of the IOC. So I had a bit of nerves, but when I came in there and I realized the people that are actually working behind the scenes and making decisions, and, like, I was actually really reassured as someone that is so invested as a, like, person in the Olympic Games and what it stands for.
Yeah.
And what it brings and the inspiration that I've had throughout my life from the Olympic Games.
You were proven that it's like, oh, they're not, they are good people in there. Well, I hoped they would be.
You read the bad news and you're like, oh, I really hope that my, like, something I've looked up to all my life isn't this bad thing, and it really isn't. So I was really relieved, and it's been really cool and special to be a part of that.
What does it involve? Like, are you guys on a Slack chat thing, or do you meet up, like, year?
We meet at least once a year. It usually, everyone goes to the Olympic Games, whether it's winter, summer, or youth.
Are you making decisions, or is it more around, you are
so
making
it's,
decisions
it's
about
kind
stuff?
Of, it's high level, so it's more like being on a board.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of staff at the IOC that do all the kind of groundwork, and they're the ones that make everything kind of fall into place.
Gotcha.
But being on the IOC,
you're like the board of trustees.
But there's 101 at the moment. So there's 101 board members, essentially. Like, there's an executive board that's above that as well. But essentially, we all have input on
that's a really
what
small,
the Olympics does.
Tiny group that you're a part of.
Yeah, well, yeah, kind of. There's 15 athletes that are on the IOC as IOC members. And there's another 4 athletes that kind of help, but don't have the official title.
Designation.
Yeah.
How long will you be part of the commission for?
For 8 years. But
great.
Yeah, so, like, last year we voted on who would host the 2026 Winter Olympic Games. And, like, I was one of the votes that got to choose who I wanted to vote
for.
Which is, like, that. Even
wait,
that
sorry,
whole
you
process,
cast a vote? Yeah. Or you guys were voting on who gets to vote?
No, I was casting a vote on which city would get the Winter Olympic Games.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Sarah, how do you keep on top of everything in terms of you've got the work with the committee, and which is huge, epic, and then you're aiming to be at the next Olympics as an athlete?
Good question. I really struggled to start with. So I've been part of the IOC since 2016, the Rio Olympics. So I'm coming up 4 years now. For the first meeting I ever went to, I probably cried halfway through the week because I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do this properly and still do my sport. It probably took a year or two to, like, figure out what that balance looks like.
Mm.
So, for example, this year there was the Youth Olympics in January where all the IOC met, but I had a World Cup first weekend of February in Australia. So they were all in Switzerland meeting, and I'm meant to be there, but the priority was to get ready for a World Cup and try to qualify for the Olympics. So I didn't go to Switzerland for this meeting.
Man.
I didn't go to Rio. So it's been
eight
since
years.
London. So yeah. eight years I've been working towards Tokyo. I might still not make it, but hopefully I do, and I'll give my best to be there. But essentially you race, and then the next day, 8 years after working towards that day for 8 years, it's like, okay.
Now what?
Yeah, now what?
And
your goal is so clear. There's a day in the future that you know that's when I got to perform.
The intensity of the training leading up, and then the intensity of competing and being in the Olympic Village, I imagine, is like a crazy thing unto itself.
Yeah.
And then all of it just goes away overnight.
Yeah. And then you're like, okay, well, what am I going to do?
What do you do? What have you done in the past? Do you go do you go to bed for 2 weeks? Do you go to a beach? Do you read books?
I think,
do you go,
like,
party?
It's changed.
Donuts.
Each one's been totally different. So after Beijing, I finished 4th and I kind of came home, but I was quite young, and it was just kind of like, oh, well, like, let's start for London. So, yeah, you just kind of get back into it. But then London, I won a medal, and you come home and you do, like, media and you go to, like, different events, and it's, like, really full-on and exciting. But at the same time, I remember then, like, I just wanted to rest and, like, do nothing. And then I felt really that I was being ungrateful for all these opportunities and that I, like, was not enjoying being a medalist because I just – all these cool things I'm going to, I just want to be at home. So, like, I felt really bad that I even had those thoughts. So, like, I felt guilty. And then it kind of finishes and then you're like, oh, wow, there's, like, another 4 years till the next one. And so it's kind of weird transitions. And then Rio, I didn't qualify, but that happened before the Olympics were even on. So it was kind of like, well, like, what am I going to do now? There's another 4 and a bit years until the next one. And like, I don't have any competitions now until like for another like 10 months. So like, what do I do? And then you're trying to figure out what you actually do if you're not training. But that was the last time I had off.
What did you do in that period?
I actually got a job broadcasting the Olympic Games.
Awesome.
So I was still involved. Cool. And it was really, really cool, and it was super beneficial too because I researched pretty much every New Zealand Olympian that was competing each day and then presented about like what to expect from Kiwis that night while they were competing. So I really found that rewarding because I had to learn about maybe new sports or new athletes that I didn't know. And then kind of educate others on like what I'd learned that day on TV. And it was really interesting. Like I learned the power, I guess, of the media as well at the same time being on the broadcasting side. So I remember like day five of the Rio Olympics, New Zealand had like 3 medals. And I heard a few people like starting to like be like, oh no, we're like going really bad. Cause I think at that point, the men hadn't made the medal playoffs for sevens. It was the first time sevens was at the Olympics. And then the woman had won the silver medal. And so New Zealand being rugby mad, they're like, oh, no, like, this is going horrible. And I looked at London, which was our most successful games ever. And on day five, we'd had 3 medals. And we're at the same point and we had 3, but actually same we tally. Were already doing, actually on paper, we were doing better than our best Olympics ever.
So and so was, you were you able to put so that message out then?
I was broadcasting, yeah. I was like able to be like, hey guys. Actually, just chill out for a second. Let's look at the facts. Here we go. And the next day I actually saw the impact of what that perception had given others. And I was like, wow, this is so powerful that just my research and me going, hey, hang on a second, this is actually the situation and here's some more facts and more information, and that changed people's perception and realities.
Amazing. That's so cool.
And it did end up being New Zealand's most successful Olympics ever.
I like that you were able to see the power of the media through giving correct information as well. Well, especially considering your packed calendar, which is giving me head spins just to think about,
yeah.
We won't take up too much more of your time, but thank you so much for joining us on this episode of How to Save the World and talking to us about what you're doing, particularly in the IOC, is so interesting.
Yeah.
And how can people find more information out about Lightfoot?
They can go to the website, lightfoot.nz, and I think they're pretty much wrapping up a lot of what they're doing, but the idea behind it and the information on everything that they've done and been doing is available on the website.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And can people read more about like the sustainability and legacy part of the IOC?
Yeah,
is that public facing?
Yeah, there is. Everything at the IOC is public facing. So you can go onto the website and search all the sustainability and legacy documents. There's like a sustainability strategy that they've got in place that's specific to that, as well as a legacy one, which is separate. But yeah, it's pretty cool what they're doing and the direction they're going in. The new IOC headquarters that they just built been awarded like the highest sustainability standards from all the major sustainability like certifications.
Awesome.
I don't know them all off the top of my head, but
where is it?
In Lausanne, Switzerland. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's like everything that they did was like locally sourced if they could. It's got solar panels that run everything. It's got lights that only switch on when there's movement so that they're not keeping lights on all day. Everything from the desks to the chairs to the carpet to the roof to the is all being considered in that whole process.
Amazing.
And that's available on the IOC website too.
In the meanwhile, thank you so much for coming on the show, Sarah.
That's right. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Cheers.
Thanks so much.